we can see that illuminated sign that marks the end of the journey.
This vaccine will help us get past this pandemic once and for all.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it. The thing that's going to stop us from seeing the end of this pandemic are people going, oh, I'm not so sure.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
Good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepker. Well, you join us for this pandemic special episode, Roger, this Friday. It is a year now since the first person in the UK died as a result of COVID-19, a woman in her 70s in a hospital in Reading. Throughout the past year, despite all the dire warnings, the NHS has held strong, with a lot of that success down to the dedication of frontline staff. So it's not surprising that the government drew anger when it recommended a 1% pay increase for NHS staff in England. The GMB union described the rise as a paltry insult to health workers.
Well, earlier we spoke to Dr. Amy Jones, who's intensive care consultant with the Nyren Bevan University Health Board and lead consultant for Welsh Flying Medics, and she questioned the lack of acknowledgement the NHS is getting for its efforts.
Everybody in the NHS had a very tough year, and I think particularly for the people like the nurses and porters and cleaners that aren't on huge wages, you know, a 1% pay rise is very little and is a real slap in the face for them.
Well, Nusrat Ghani, Conservative MP for Wealden, told us she is in favour of better pay for NHS workers, but says they must wait for the process to be complete.
The 1% is a starting negotiation position. You know, the pay rise is done in consultation with the unions, and as you said, it is a process. Let's see where we are.
But what would you like to see come out of it? Surely it's reasonable to ask that.
I'd always like to see more payment to key workers on the front line. NHS are our key workers. And to see, you know, to be able to give them the greatest pay rise that we can under the financial circumstances.
So Nusrat Ghani, Conservative MP there. Now, the Mental Health Minister, Nadine Dorris, told Sky News today that the 1% rise was what the government could afford. She insisted that NHS workers had been prioritised for a pay rise, whilst other public sector workers were facing a pay freeze.
Well, in today's special Bloomberg Westminster, we're going to be looking at the experience of frontline NHS staff during the past 12 months and at the larger lessons the UK can draw about handling this kind of crisis and improving the health system to make it more resilient to deal with any future pandemic. Joining us now is one of the UK's most prominent voices from the frontline, Nikki Credland, Head of Department for Paramedical, Perioperative and Advanced Practice at the University of Hull, also Chair of the British Association of Critical Care Nurses. Nikki, thanks so much for being with us. Looking back, let me ask you this first, over the last 12 months, is there one image in your mind that kind of sticks, that characterises everything you and people like you have been through?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember seeing a photograph on Twitter of three intensive care nurses, all in their PPE with their masks, their visors, their hats, gloves, aprons, etc. Hugging each other, obviously crying, obviously in tears, obviously at the end of a very, very traumatic shift. And that, to me, just resonated how every single critical care nurse in the entire country has felt for an awful lot of this year.
Yeah, what pressure. What do you know now that you wish you'd known back in March last year?
I think we probably need a whole programme to cover that, to be honest. There's, you know, there's a lot about patient care. So the way that we actually manage patients who have COVID-19, you know, things about using non-invasive ventilation rather than invasive ventilation, different types of drug therapies, different types of medication management. So, you know, that's a really important element, our ability to be able to manage those patients effectively to get better outcomes for our patients. I think we would have, you know, it would have been really useful to have had a better understanding about the concept of long COVID and what that means for our patients moving forward. You know, mm-hmm. for patients that have been critically ill and are going through a long journey towards recovery, but also for members of the general public who maybe got a very mild dose or in fact maybe didn't even realise they had COVID at all, but are now facing repercussions of obviously getting COVID at some point in the past. That's significant. And in terms of staffing and workforce, I don't think any of us estimated just how significant the cumulative effect of this experience would be. certainly from an intensive care point of view, were very resilient in terms of managing very, very difficult situations. And have lots of individual and collective and team coping strategies around that. But what you can't plan for is when you are encountering an experience that is so awful and so horrific, and it continues day on day on day, week on week, month on month, for, let's face it, over a year now. And that cumulative effect of that stress that builds up on staff, it is really being seen now with staff with post-traumatic stress, staff going off sick, etc. So a huge amount of learning, I think, to take place.
Yeah, Nikki, I mean, I suppose one of the key things that sticks in a lot of people's minds is that there were concepts that we might be facing a pandemic in the past, and some people say, well, there wasn't the right organisation in place, certainly in terms of the way hospitals work. And we know that once it came along, there was this idea of Nightingale hospitals, big new areas, many of which were never really used because it wasn't a question of space, it was a question of staff. I mean, things like that. Were we simply unprepared, do you think?
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about, you know, pre-COVID, so we went into a global pandemic with the least ratio of intensive care beds to population head ratio in the entire in all of Europe. We also went into a pandemic with 40,000 nurses short already. That's before we even got hit with COVID. So the NHS was already under significant pressure before we add a pandemic on top of that. So to say it was already on the back foot was probably, you know, major understatement of the year.
So then, looking to the future, what would most help people like you in order to deal with any future similar crisis? I mean, we may not even be out of the woods in terms of just next winter.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly from, you know, obviously I'm very involved in the critical care community from a national point of view, and all of us are very concerned about what our next steps are going to be, what the implications of coming down out of lockdown are going to be, if we're going to continue to see escalation of COVID cases, which we are seeing in some areas across the country. For me, there needs to be a really significant look at NHS and social care provision. There needs to be an absolute understanding that without the protection of the staff that work within those environments, it will impact negatively on patient care. So if you don't recruit and retain highly qualified, educated staff with lots of knowledge and expertise to be able to manage patients, then you will fail to protect the public, you will fail to protect the sick, and you will fail to protect the vulnerable. And that is what everybody that goes into healthcare professions wants to do, whether they are doctors, nurses, healthcare assistants, physiotherapists, porters, operating department practitioners. It doesn't matter. The ethos of healthcare professions is the same.
But Nikki, the point within that, and I'm sort of screaming out at us now, is that people who are recruited for that need to be paid reasonably well to get the best people, to get the motivation, to get all those things, which, you know, no one's saying motivation is pay, but it helps for sure. And at the moment we've now got this announcement that the government is recommending a 1% rise for NHS workers. Many people have said it's inadequate, some have said it's an insult. What do you think?
And I must admit, I do agree that it's insulting. You know, in real terms, NHS workers, nurses, doctors, etc., particularly nursing staff and those on a gender for change contract, have seen a 20% pay cut in real terms over the last 10 years. So, you know, to suggest that, and I know it's only the beginning of a bargaining conversation, but even so, to start with a 1% is simply insulting. And you're absolutely right that, you know, pay is only a small element of the reasons why people choose to do the jobs that they do, but actually pay has a lot has a direct relationship with respect, and you know, the healthcare professionals, and again, this is a multidisciplinary group of people, we're not just talking about nurses here, we're talking about nurses and operating department practitioners and physios, etc. They deserve a pay rise commensurate with the knowledge and skills and expertise that is required to be a healthcare professional in the 21st century. And that is every single member of this population's responsibility, because we will all call on healthcare at some point in our lives. And we all want to be treated with the expertise that we expect. And that is the only way that we're going to do it.
Do you then have confidence that the government is going to do what's necessary, not just in terms of pay, but more broadly about the investment needed for NHS resources? I mean, it's an issue also for catch up in terms of teaching, but it is clearly a huge issue for the structure of the NHS.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to get into a political conversation particularly, but, you know, I don't have a lot of confidence that, certainly from a workforce perspective, that the government has adequate grasp on the severity of the situation in relation to the workforce. Now, if we just choose, you know, nursing as an example, because quite obviously that's my own profession, you know, I mentioned that we've got 40,000 nurses short before the pandemic even hit. We've now got record numbers of nurses leaving the NHS. Half of nurses who are registered general nurses on the NMC register don't work in the NHS. They've left the NHS to work in a variety of settings, but often into private sector employment because the pay is better.
Yeah.
So again, we need to go back to the idea that we have got to, you know, financially recompense and make sure that healthcare professionals work in an environment that is conducive to protecting themselves as individuals and as employees, to allow them to deliver expert care.
In the last year, since the pandemic began, the UK has had one of the highest death rates per capita in the world, but also one of the fastest vaccine rollouts. Last year, the NHS came under intense pressure, nearing overcapacity, a situation that was only averted by the most recent strict lockdown and the government's vaccine programme. Joining us now to take stock of what we've learnt over these months is the CEO of the King's Fund, Richard Murray. Richard, thank you so much for being with us. Look, you've done a lot of research about recovery and resilience in healthcare, what we should do now, but I'd like you to reflect and look backwards a little. Why did, in your opinion, the UK suffer so many deaths? I know that the reasons are often complicated, but what is your conclusion right now about that?
I think there are two key drivers of the high death rate in the United Kingdom. One is, to some extent, we were one of the countries that was already more exposed to a pandemic. So high levels of international travel, a high proportion of elderly people, and unfortunately a high level of many of the risk factors for COVID, like diabetes and obesity. But of course, many other countries in Europe were in much the same place as us. That might explain the differences between the United Kingdom and Africa, for example, or parts of Asia, but not with Europe. For those differences, much of this really relates to the public health measures, the timing of the lockdown, how strict the lockdown was, controls over international travel. Once COVID got into the country and was circulating as far as it did amongst the community, it was extremely difficult, really, to end up in any outcome that didn't have a lot of deaths, I'm afraid.
And was there also a lack of preparedness? I mean, a lot of attention has been drawn to a project called Cygnus that was supposed to model a pandemic. And I think it was a couple of years ago, some of the funding was withdrawn from it. Were we simply caught napping, really, where we should have at least had some measure of proper preparation?
So I think when we would expect there's going to be a full inquiry into what decisions were taken and when, I think that is one of the kind of smoking guns. But Britain was often actually considered really rather well prepared by many other international bodies, but well prepared for a flu pandemic. Flu is not the same as coronavirus. And there was a moment, and modelling was updated to recognise that this wasn't SARS, the previous coronavirus epidemic that spread across Asia, and it wasn't flu. And there seems to have been a bit of a delay in really realising we were handling a very, very different infection. So in that sense, yes, I think the questions that will be important then is, was all the learning taken from those parts, particularly East Asia, Taiwan, Korea, that may not perhaps have been as well prepared for a flu pandemic, but did seem to react much more quickly, seemed to be much more ready for COVID-19, with a bit of suspicion that they learned from SARS and MERS and the other outbreaks of coronavirus that never really reached the United Kingdom.
Yeah. Also, in terms of your research, now kind of describing the aftermath of this, you've done a lot of work on this, saying that it's not linear, that now this has happened. In fact, the whole country faces a huge sort of road back, an emotional recovery process, and that actually now it's time not just to focus on rebuilding the NHS, but also to really focus on mental health.
Yes, we've looked a lot at kind of international learning on other disasters, other enormous crises that have struck, and how you're trying to help people and help communities out of that. There is, of course, a big element for health and social care staff who will have seen so many people pass away, and indeed will have lost many of their own colleagues and been right in the eye of the storm for so long. But of course, we've also seen many communities, they've been isolated. People have been in their own homes, separated from their contacts, from their friends and loved ones, children not in school. And these create long-term shocks to communities, particularly to those parts of the communities that may have lacked some of the resilience, lower-income groups, for example, even before the pandemic struck. And we did see the pandemic really hit both ethnic minorities in the United Kingdom, but lower-income people as well. And that needs some real thought about how you work with communities, how you get alongside them to help them deal with some of the emotional issues that will have been experienced. And there is some learning in this country too from the recovery from Grenfell, which, of course, is a very specific place in, again, went through many of those kind of learning and healing processes.
And I mean, you draw some interesting parallels. In fact, I think also with New Zealand after the earthquake there, of course, after September the 11th, everyone remembers the kind of difficulties of getting back from that. But it's going to be something as simple as prioritising the well-being of a workforce. I mean, the mental health issues and potentially physical health issues that come from the huge changes we've all undergone.
It does. And the workforce, of course, both healthcare but more widely, the experience of furlough for many people for a long period of time is not really much of a paid holiday. But also wouldn't want to lose the impact on children, both because of the end of face-to-face education for most of them, what that will mean for their life chances and what it's meant for their own development, but also the fact that they've been isolated again from their social circle for such a long time. There's a big issue here, folks, but there's a really very big one for children, making sure that we can try and get back to some normality as soon as we can, but also think about ways to re-engage them, catch up on some of the education that they may have lost, but also on some of the development that they will have lost through this very, very strange, what's now, soon to be more than a year.
The Prime Minister in the past few weeks has looked a lot more sober. He's been a lot more cautious about lifting now this third lockdown that we're in. So, you know, a lot of people have talked about the lessons are being learnt from the past year, from the sort of early mistakes. Are you convinced of that? What lessons do you think have actually not been learnt as we look to school reopenings, to the summer holidays, to the lockdowns being lifted?
So I think it certainly is a much more cautious approach. And as I say, the key to the high death rate in this country is really around the speed with which the lockdown was brought in, and then how slow it was to be reimposed again, accepting that there was an unfortunate development in the United Kingdom of the Kent variant that I don't think you can blame politicians for. I think there's two pieces of learning. One is to make sure that the early warning mechanisms are really in place. So if there's a sign of an uptick of the virus, that we don't wait until cases start rising in hospital and the deaths start going up, because what COVID has shown us over and over again, that is too late. That means the virus is already spreading amongst the community, and there's an inevitable lag before the real peak follows in hospital care and in deaths. But I do think there's one other lesson here as well. The United Kingdom started back before COVID hit already much lower on things like the number of doctors, the number of nurses, the number of hospital beds, the amount of healthcare staff that we had than most other European countries and North America too. And so we've relied on exceptional effort from staff to deal with a huge upsurge in cases. I think as we look forward now again to recovery, we need to be really careful before, if you like, switching off the COVID button and then suddenly asking them to work weekends and overtime again to try and bring down waiting times and to try and get the health service back to where it was in 2019, or indeed better, because, of course, the government had proposals then to improve the health service. And so one of the lessons, I think, here that we really mustn't lose is health and social care are really about the workforce, and they should be front and centre of all our thinking. If you may remember, there was a panic at the start that we would run out of ventilators. We didn't run out of ventilators. And you know what? Ventilators aren't a lot of good if you have the professionals to work them. And over again, the experience of this country was the workforce that really mattered.
OK, Richard, let me ask you to take a sort of step back and say, how well do you think the NHS coped in all this? Yeah, kind of marks out of 10, I suppose, although that's a bit banal. But a sense of, was it up to the task in the end?
Remembering that, as I say, the NHS started this very short of resource and government commitments, if you may remember, in the election, and increased quite sharply the number of nurses, the number of GPs and other clinical staff as well, physiotherapists and others, recognising that we're in a major shortage. What I think is actually quite remarkable is, given that how common COVID became in this country, that NHS that was so short of resource didn't seem to buckle. It did seem to provide care, certainly to people with COVID. There have been gaps for people without COVID as other parts of the system have been suspended. And so some real strength, I think, came through from the NHS from that. Its ability to cooperate with itself. So it wasn't that each hospital stood on its own as waves of COVID patients came through the door. People were swapping resources, swapping staff, redirecting patients. It connected with the voluntary sector much more strongly than perhaps ever in its history. That helped people stay well at home, helped those that were shielding, provided a lot of volunteer support to the NHS. And it did switch to digital very, very quickly, where that was possible, to try and reduce the number of face-to-face contacts. So I think the core strength of the NHS did come through very loudly through this process. But what it leaves us wondering is, in many ways, why did it start back in March with so few resources to begin with, and really a lot of the attention on, again, as I say, that public health response, the decisions over lockdown? It left many parts of the health service, indeed social care and wider society, really as the victim of COVID.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.